Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
This is Michael Harlan Turkel, host of The Food Scene. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 160 of The Morning After. I'm Jesse Kiefer. My co-host Sari Kamen is still in Berlin, making us all proud. She'll be back in the next 2 weeks. On today's show, head baker and managing partner of Sidel's, Melissa Weller. Woo! Later in the show, Melissa will try her luck with this week's Morning After quiz. But first, let's take a look at this week's bizarre food news. And Melissa, I want you to weigh in on, you know, your feelings about this week's bizarre food news. Okay?
My pleasure.
Okay. And again, it's wonderful to have you here.
It's my pleasure.
All right. So, first story of the week. A food truck in Austin, Texas is catching flack for its rather blunt name, White Girl Asian Food.
Sorry.
Well, some people are outraged, saying this is just another example of white privilege and the commodification of other people's cultures, while the owners say they're simply telling it like it is versus claiming to make authentic Asian food. So, I mean, I feel like this is kind of like a thug kitchen thing where people are like, oh, this is the commodification of other cultures. How do you feel about that?
I don't think it's the owner's intent to be discriminatory in any way. I think they're just saying, this is what our food is. It's our interpretation of Asian food, and we happen to be Caucasian. We're white. I don't think it's discriminatory.
I feel the same way as you do, but I do understand why people would be frustrated with it. I mean, I think they could say something like, you know, two American girls make Asian food or something like that. But then I guess that could still imply Americans of Asian descent.
Yeah. a couple months ago in the fall, I tagged something on Instagram. I think I tagged it White Girl Queen Amon, just sort of as a joke. It was a pumpkin Queen Amon.
Yeah.
It was
white
girls, pound white girls. It was just, the intent was a joke. Just in terms of like culturally, you know, what it's a French pastry. We've reinterpreted it here in New York or in the States, and it there was no malintent. But of course,
did you get backlash?
No, I think people thought it was funny. It was meant very lightheartedly, so I don't know what their intent is. I think if it was me, I don't necessarily think I'd call my own food truck White Girls Asian Cuisine. You know,
yeah, I mean,
that
it's,
doesn't make sense.
It's kind of a shitty name.
It is. It really is.
Well, actually, apparently they do have another name for the truck, but they took that off because people didn't know what it was. So it was called Com Bun Yo, which is like, which means rice noodle love in Vietnamese.
Maybe they could just call it rice noodle love.
Yeah.
I mean, I think at this point, I don't know if they chose their white girl Asian food because people would comment on it, but now everyone's commented. Maybe they can change their name.
Yeah, I mean, but also sometimes even bad publicity is good publicity.
Yeah, I think somebody once told me all publicity is good publicity.
Yeah, even if you've got a sex tape out there. Yeah. All right, so the next story is a case of mistaken identity. Claire Varon was ordering her daily meal at McDonald's when she spotted a disheveled man eating ketchup packets at a table outside. She felt sorry for his state and decided to be a good Samaritan and order him a breakfast sandwich. But to her surprise, as she gave him the breakfast sandwich, a McDonald's employee came running outside with the man's actual order that he had ordered and apologized for the delay. I was mortified, said Claire. I didn't stick around to see if he ate the food I bought him. I just ran out of the shop as quickly as I could. She went on to say, I thought only desperation could lead to someone to eat ketchup packets. So she actually thought this guy was homeless, bought him a sandwich, and he wasn't.
That's okay. I think that's okay. Did he get the sandwich that she gave to him?
Oh, yeah. She gave him the sandwich and then ran away because she was like, oh, my God, this guy is, he probably just like had a really long night last night.
Yeah.
And he's starving. And he's like, yeah. I got to have the hangover favorite. I don't know. Maybe he had to take some medication and he was like, oh, I just got to eat these ketchup.
No, you never know with people. You never know. You know, what's one thing could turn out to be something completely different.
Exactly.
I think the intent was good there, though. Like, her intent was good.
It was, and I think that he's going to have that day where he says to his friends, like, oh, I was like wearing my sweatpants and my, like, you know, my ripped up painting shirt to the McDonald's, and some chick thought I was homeless.
Maybe he thought she wanted to pick him up. I don't know.
You're right. That's how she should have played it off.
Yeah, she could have. She totally could have.
She totally could have. Have you ever been mistaken for, like, someone in that kind of a way? Or
have I?
Yeah, I'm not a homeless person, but, like, so my example is that I almost always get mistaken for the wait staff at restaurants. Okay. So I was at, speaking of white girl and Asian food, I was in a Korean restaurant and all of the servers were Korean, and I went up to go to the bathroom, mm-hmm. and a table flagged me down. And they were like, excuse me. I turn around. I have blonde hair.
Yeah.
Radio listeners, I have blonde hair. And I'm a white girl. excuse me, miss. I turn around and I say, yes. And he's like, can we get the bill? And he does the little, the hand gesture, the writing gesture. And I'm like, I'm not your server.
But you look pretty responsible.
I don't work here. I guess so. But
you,
like, again, we're in a Korean restaurant. No. Everyone is Korean in there.
Everyone's Korean.
I don't look Korean that I know of.
But you don't know what he was thinking. He could be completely out of it guy.
I mean, I think he has face blindness.
Yes. Probably so. You never know what other people are thinking.
And then, you don't know this about me yet, Melissa, but I really love Red Lobster.
Oh.
Because I love dinner and a show.
Yeah.
It's very much an entertaining moment for me. And I was doing inventory at one of the restaurants I was working at. So wine inventory, mm-hmm. you know, you're in a cellar. It's cold. So you're wearing like your shitty long sleeve shirt or sweatshirt or whatever, a beanie maybe. So then I go to meet friends at Red Lobster because, again, I love dinner and a show. And I'm wearing a Riviera Produce.
Oh, yeah.
Long sleeve shirt.
Yeah.
Standing by the hostess stand. And someone walks up to me and they're like, hi, are you the hostess? In a Riviera, like, in the dirt, like, I kind of looked like this guy, like somebody would have bought me McDonald's, maybe.
But you do have a responsible-looking face.
I guess so.
I mean, it has to be related to that.
Melissa, you're making me feel better about this. You really are.
You should feel better about this. They're looking towards you as a figure of authority. Help us, they're saying.
I mean, and I guess I do know how to stand up straight in a restaurant and be in charge.
Just standing up straight and being in charge goes a long way, regardless of what you're wearing.
Or what my ethnicity is.
Or what your ethnicity is. Yes, apparently so.
All right. Okay. So that's never happened to you?
I'm tall.
You are tall. Yes.
Very tall. The only time that I recall getting strange looks is when I used to finish working at Roberta's and I'd be wearing a Carhartt jacket, flower covered boots, and I'd be covered with in Carhartt pants. And I looked disheveled, and I'd be riding the subway home, and people would look at me like, what are you doing? Where are you going?
Because if you were riding the subway to Bushwick, no one would question you, riding it back towards Williamsburg.
Yes, exactly. So I got a lot of looks for that.
I decided
that I should change what I was wearing on my way home from work after that.
Because you're covered in flour.
Well, the boots were covered, caked with flour. The Carhartt pants and big heavy overcoat were sort of dusty. I smelled like smoke from the fire. You know, it was sort of like that.
But that sounds kind of badass. I'd go up and be like, high five. I don't know where you just were, but you
looking
seem
back
awesome.
At it now, I sort of like it. But back at that time, I was like, oh my God, what did they think I am? Or what
don't
am I
sit
doing?
Next to me.
Yeah, it was sort of like that.
Okay. Well, I'm glad that we can kind of be in the same boat a little bit. All right. Well, finally, we love stupid criminal stories on The Morning After. This week, Border Patrol agents on the Mexico-Texas border came across some pretty suspicious, incredibly fake-looking carrots. Did you hear about this story?
No, I haven't heard about it.
So upon further investigation, they found 2,493 pounds of marijuana stuffed inside the carrots.
Oh my gosh.
So it basically looks like someone bought like a ton of orange duct tape.
Oh.
Put the marijuana in like plastic bags, like cylindrical bags, and then just wrapped duct tape around it.
Oh.
Threw it into a bag of carrots. The bag itself is like see-through orange.
Yeah.
And tried to pass it off as actual carrots. So apparently this is not the first time smugglers have used carrots to bring drugs across the border.
Yeah.
And so obviously these other smugglers should have really checked the news, because only 5 weeks ago, U.S. Customs officers found 164 pounds of cocaine stuffed in bags of carrots also.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy. What, how big are these carrots?
So they're like,
these
they
are the horse carrots.
Yeah, they look like the, you know, total carrots. GMO, yes. You know, Monsanto.
I've seen those.
Carrots. Yeah,
you cook exactly. Stock with those carrots.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, this would be a really flavorful stock.
A really flavorful stock indeed.
But yeah, there's pictures of the carrots. They're like sliced open. It really is like duct tape just like wrapped around in the shape
so
of a carrot.
It's just duct tape in the shape of a carrot. It's not really carrot, but they're packed with the carrots.
Not at all. So then, Melissa, okay. My brain went to like, how could we really, could you really stuff carrots full of weed? Like
That's
actual
what
carrots.
I was thinking when you first mentioned the story.
Yeah. So then like, you know, you could, I feel like I've seen Alton Brown take a drill and like drill a hole in a carrot. Or
you could
or
do something
somebody.
Like that. That'd be a lot of work. I feel like there would be an easier way to figure it out.
Well, it's not duct taping
no,
a bunch of marijuana.
That wasn't thinking too. I don't know who these guys were, but I felt like, seems like they didn't think it through.
It was not MacGyver. They were stoners. MacGyver, that's what happened. Exactly. They're like, we're just going to get some duct tape, man. And it's going to be totally kosher. We'll be fine. It's just carrots. Like, who's going to think that? All right, I'm going to stop. But anyway, I think we should just stop buying those big giant carrots.
I would love to. They're scary looking. Those carrots are scary looking.
They are. You could actually injure someone with those.
Yeah, and you can order them from Riviera Produce.
Shh. Yes.
Oops.
Oh, no. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, goodness. Didn't mean to say that.
You can, and I'm sure you can order.
They do. You order them. You order, like, the horse carrots.
And you make stock because you need a bigger...
Because you need a lot of carrots, and it's a lot less... It's less labor.
No, absolutely. So... Again, like, people don't use produce to do
this. I try
this.
To avoid those carrots at home.
Yes.
I get the little skinny ones with the carrot top still
attached.
Yeah,
me too. Or I get, like, the, like, yellow ones or the purple ones.
Those ones are good, too.
So, I mean, I think, the moral of the story is don't do drugs, don't buy big carrots.
Bingo.
Okay, we're going to take a break here on The Morning After. We're going to come back with Melissa Weller of Siddell's.
National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
And we're back here on The Morning After. Bagels are synonymous with New York City, but there are far more bad bagels than good. At Siddell's, managing partner and head baker, Melissa Weller, is going to change all that. She is changing all of that. Welcome to The Morning After, Melissa.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, how did you get involved with Major Food Group to open Siddell's?
I started when I left Roberta's, I started selling my bagels at the Smorgasburg. And there was a press article in New York Magazine talking about my bagels. And I was contacted by an investor with the Major Food Group. And he's like, this is great. I'd love to meet you. So I met with him. I had lunch with him. I brought him bagels. He loved the bagels. He's like, you really ought to meet these guys. And so I delivered bagels to one of my partner's doors Saturday morning, along with some sticky buns and cream cheese. And the rest is basically history.
So tell me, why bagels? Why did you? Because you were at Roberta's and you left to open a stand, a bagel stand.
I left because I wanted to open up my own bakery, and in head, this bakery would have included bread and pastries and just sort of like a bakery cafe. And I wanted a fun project. I was, you know, I'd worked so long just working with sourdough. I'm like, let me do something fun. Let's do something fun while I'm working on this business plan. And I'm like, bagels are fun. And I just wanted something. To me, they are.
Okay, cool.
I was like, I just want something fun that I can do over the summer at the Smorgasburg while I work on this business plan, which was daunting to me. Working on a business plan was like putting the numbers and crunching and figuring out everything.
Yeah, you went to ICC, getting your MBA somewhere.
Exactly, yes. So I was like, let's do bagels. They are fun. And I knew if I did the Smorgasburg that I wanted something that people could eat along the way and not like a loaf of bread that they would take home with them. So bagels have always been close to my heart. I'm not Jewish, but I love the chewiness and the bagels and like the crisp outside. And it's something that I've always enjoyed making. They're not that hard to make. So I'm like, let's make bagels and let's see what happens.
Why do you think, so when I say there are bad bagels, there are bad bagels.
Yes.
There are big, giant, like huge bagels, yes. Doughy bagels.
They weigh
like
a pound each.
Why, if you're saying bagels are not that hard to make, like why are there so many bad bagels in New York?
Bagels aren't hard to make, so everybody can make them.
Okay.
But just in terms of who is making them and what your perception is and, you know, what your background is and what your point of view is. That's sort of what, you know, I don't come from the bagel world. Like you sort of think of bakeries in the city and bagel bakeries are never included in that lot. Like you've got these artisan bakeries, like even like Sullivan Street and Amy's Bread, who've been around a while, who in the 90s started a bread revolution. No one had started a bagel revolution and bagels were always sort of separate. And so it was, you know, because bagels were sort of separate, I don't think that the same people were involved in making bagels. And I think that there's, you know, since bagels are so easy, there, you know, there was this one sort of point of view that propagated that bigger bagels are better.
Because people want more bread or something. I mean, but then it
started with the whole supersize me, didn't it? Like with big lattes and big French fries and lots of big things in the 90s.
I'm not the only one
who was thinking there've got to be better bagels in the city.
Sure.
And you can see that just, you know, through Black Seed and Russ and Daughters, who also opened up at around the same, before Sidell's actually. Mm-hmm. But we were all, I'm sure more people were thinking, why aren't there better bagels? Like, why are the bagels these like sort of like bodega type delis that you go into and order something with the like the linoleum floors, you know, or tile floors? Like, why hasn't anybody like made this better? Because there are lots of other cuisines in the city that people have made better. So why didn't somebody like jump in and make bagels better? And so it's interesting. It's just sort of interesting how bagels are bread. It's mm-hmm. a type of bread. And how did it become so separate, you know, from other bread baking? And just, you know, knowing that and, you know, taking that, you know, taking my perspective as a bread baker, I felt that I had something to offer.
Absolutely. So how do you, in your mind, because I think obviously Russ and Daughters and Sidell's, you guys have different perspective. Black Seed Bagels has different
yes.
perspective. Mile End has different perspective, those kind of things.
Yes.
So what is your approach to the perfect bagel?
My approach is a bread baker's approach. I've been a bread baker for a long time. And so for me, it's all about fermentation and flavor. And the longer you ferment something, the more flavor it has. So my ideal bread and my ideal bagel is something that you take a long time to make. So that means, you know, you shape the bagel and then you let it sit overnight in the walk-in to develop its flavor. And I use sourdough starter to add that flavor. I'm not using sourdough starter as something that makes it sour. I'm using it as a, you know, something that adds flavor to the dough. And mm-hmm. I always employ sourdough starter that way. So my approach is really, you know, how would a bread baker make the best bagel, but still make sure that the bagel is true to what a bagel should be and not make the bagel become a bread. if that makes sense, even though I just said that bagels are bread.
But they're different. They're different. Bread. So so how have you approached kind of the classics, like the everything, the onion bagel? My favorite is sesame seed.
Oh, my favorite is sesame seed too. Well, the everything was interesting because I first started making a pumpernickel everything at Roberta's. And I was like, I don't know what the seeds are on an everything bagel. And so I remember at the time talking with Max Sussman, I'm like, what's on an everything bagel? And we were sort of talking back and forth and we're like, well, you know, sesame seed and poppy seed and salt. And then we were like, well, we think that there's caraway seeds and fennel seeds. And so we just added those in. And so my first approach to that bagel was to add those seeds in. And then upon a little bit more research, I'm like, oh, an everything bagel is only sesame seeds, poppy seeds, salt, and garlic and onion. And I was like, oh, that's very interesting because I was making something with fennel. I was sort of like Italianizing the bagel. So that was our approach to the everything bagel. In terms of like approaching other bagels and approaching them classically, you know, for me, keeping the size small is important. I don't like that it's too big. And then just keeping, you know, approaching the baking in a way that's consistent with how New York bagels are baked was important to me throughout the process.
Versus so, like I've been to Montreal and they're doing like a wood fired oven kind of style. And I think the New York style is different.
Exactly. And I think that's beautiful. And I love that. I love the aroma of the sesame seeds in a wood fired oven. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that has drawn me to black seed bagels is mm-hmm. that aroma. I wanted to use a traditional bagel oven. And so that's a revolving tray oven. So if you're looking at the oven head on, it's like looking at a Ferris wheel going around. And there's a gas heat source at the bottom. And the bagels bake on a deck. So it's sort of like a cross between a bread oven and a convection oven. And it provides that convective heat that gives the bagels an additional shine and results in a really beautiful oven spring of the bagels and is pretty true to what a New York bagel is in terms of like a softer interior and a really crispy crust.
So to be a bagel maker or just to be a baker in general, do you kind of have to be like a geek about?
I think so.
All yes. this stuff.
I'm a geek, right? You can tell just in what I'm talking to you about.
Well,
right?
I just want to, I think a lot of this is coming from me just reading Julia Child's My Time in France.
Yeah.
And she's talking about learning how to make the perfect French baguette and all yes. of the different experiments. I mean, just all the different experiments she did throughout,
yes.
you know, her putting together the Mastering the Art of French mm-hmm. Cooking. So, but how did you do your research for the, bagels.
Okay. So I guess you should understand that first I have a chemical engineering background. So
that
I,
makes a lot of sense.
So I
you're,
approach
you're every, a scientist.
Yes, I'm a scientist. So I approach everything with somewhat of a scientific method.
Okay.
And I test things out and I see if they work. Bagels, you know, with any kind of bread, you start with a recipe. You start with sort of idea of, you know, what you think the recipe should be. And, I read books, cookbooks, you try to find, you know, what recipes people have used in cookbooks and procedures and any kind of book. It doesn't have to be a cookbook. It could be like just a history book of bagels, which I did. There's a book called, I think, Bagels or The Bagel out there. And I read it.
The Bagel. Is it The Bagel book?
It might be. Exactly. It talks a lot about the history. It really talks about how bagels are made. I watched a lot of YouTube videos. There's this really wonderful video from the Brooklyn Public Library, and I think it was shot in the 70s, early 70s, of a bagel bakery in Brooklyn. It's really interesting to see like how they treat the dough and how they're baking the bagels. And so I tested a lot of recipes, watched a lot of videos, I did a lot of reading, and I sort of, you know, tested the bagels myself in different ovens to come up with what I thought was like perfect bagel.
Did you have like a test kitchen while you were doing this?
I did a lot of my testing at the Hot Bread Kitchen incubator space. And then I was up there for a couple of years testing, renting a kitchen space from them. And then I also tested bagels at different bagel bakeries throughout the city. I begged and pleaded different stores to let me use their ovens to test my bagels. That was a little tricky to organize. I don't think they were all very happy about it, but they were all very accommodating and very nice.
So in addition to bagels, what else are you baking at Sidell's?
Well, in addition to bagels, we're baking pastries. So we're making babka, rucola, sticky buns, cakes and cookies, pastries, and different breads that don't necessarily make their way at the retail counter, but are used in the sandwiches at the restaurant.
Yeah, I was going to ask if almost every dish on the Sedell's appetizing menu have one of your breads involved.
It does. There are no breads except the breads that we make at the bakery that are used at the restaurant. So, for example, there's a triple-decker sandwich, and it uses the rye bread that we make at the bakery. There's a egg sandwich, and it's using challah that we make. So everything sort of uses a different bread that we make at the bakery.
I was working at Samia, which I was telling you about, and Pam Young there is an amazing baker.
Yes, she's lovely.
I would often have to have the conversation with people who said they didn't eat gluten.
Oh.
How have you combated that? Because obviously it's a bread-forward menu at Sedell's.
It is. Well, so first we offer gluten-free bagel. So if you want...
That's very generous of you.
Very generous. So if you are gluten, if you have a gluten intolerance, there's a gluten-free bagel. Otherwise, I mean, there are lots of egg dishes and fish dishes, and you can certainly eat something. There are salads. You can eat something without the bread in it. It's pretty easy.
How do you feel about the kind of the bread backlash that a lot of people are... I mean, I feel like a lot of people are on board with that.
I'm okay with it as long as people understand actually what they're backlashing against.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like it when somebody is backlashes against bread and then chooses gluten-free products, because I think ultimately if the gluten-free product is made with a lot of starches and like binders like xanthan gum, I ultimately feel it's less healthy of a choice than just forgoing gluten altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you can't consume gluten, then I completely understand, hey, I want a bagel, I'm going to have a gluten-free bagel. But if you're making a dietary decision and you can't eat gluten and you just don't want to eat gluten and then you substitute it with a gluten-free product, I think you should just say, hey, no gluten whatsoever. And I'm fine with that. I think that that's a good choice. And I think too, along those lines, just understanding grains and flour and the history of those, which I'm sure Pam probably spewed to you.
Oh, of course.
It's really, really important in understanding where these allergies are coming from.
Yeah, because it's not really the bread itself. It's actually the grains going into it.
It's the grains.
That are not coming from a healthy place.
Exactly.
And have been GMO'd out.
Exactly.
So you were the head baker at Per Se.
Yes.
And I'm dying to talk to you about this because a very scathing review of Per Se came out in the New York Times this week from Pete Wells, where, I mean, his last line, I think, was, is Per Se worth the money?
Yes, I think that's a good question.
Yeah. And I am someone who's never actually eaten at Per Se.
Yes.
I've, of course, heard of it. I've heard of it being a standard. I read the service included book by one of the servers there. And, you know, I know people who have worked there, but how has this giant of service, how has that fallen? I mean, you've been in the behind the scenes of that.
Well, I think Per Se opened in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's quite easy whether they've fallen or not. Pete's review said they've fallen.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's quite easy to do that over time. I think it's really hard for a restaurant to maintain that the same energy and the same innovation and the same enthusiasm for that long a period of time. But I think also the review was pointing to the fact that does the amount that they're charging is that equivalent to what you're getting? So if the tasting menu was less, would the review have been, you know, the same? I think that's the question.
Do you think that it's also because Per Se is one of the, yes, the most expensive restaurants in New York City, but also kind of like the standard bearer of fine dining New York?
Yeah, it absolutely has been the standard bearer of fine dining. It's, you know, I think that that's what makes it so much harder, you know, to look at the review. You're like, did it really come down so much since, you know, I worked there from 2008 to 2010. And I'm like, has the service really changed and have the, you know, the chef de parties who are putting together the dishes, are they of the same quality? Is the innovation still happening in the same way that it was when I was there? I don't know the answer to that question, mm-hmm. but it sounds like that it has changed. Mm-hmm. And that's disconcerting. I also hope that, I hope in the future that, you know, they make changes. I would love to see it like regain those two stars. And usually the chefs at Perse are fighters and they make the changes that are necessary. Mm-hmm. I like how other restaurants that are also of the same caliber have changed, how they say, hey, we're going to close for a little bit and then we're going to come back as something different. Like, mm-hmm. like 11 Madison Park, for mm-hmm. example, how they've changed their menu.
Well, I mean, and I think that's a really good example of continuing to innovate because now, you know, restaurants, as we sit here in Roberta's, there's a two Michelin star restaurant right behind us called Blanca out in the middle of Bushwick. Mm-hmm. And no matter how trendy Bushwick is, it's still way out in the middle of Bushwick.
It is.
But that restaurant is getting the, you know, the accolades and the praise.
It's changing.
And they're changing the, you know, the conversation. Yeah.
They're changing and growing. Everybody changes. It's just how do you change? How do you maintain the interest of the chefs who are coming in to cook for you? Mm-hmm. Because there's always the hot new restaurant that everybody wants to work at. And is Perse still perceived that way? I think there are so many more amazing restaurants since Perse opened in 2004. The same can be said of bakeries. In 2004, it was pretty innovative that Perse was opening up a bakery, Bouchon Bakery, mm-hmm. Because there weren't that many bakeries in New York City. And so you get a lot of new talent that way. And then you want to keep that talent by innovating and changing and creating. So I don't know what types of innovations Perse has made in the last 12 years.
Well, I think when you have such a solid customer base that maybe you can kind of step back and relax a little bit about things. And that's not necessarily a good thing. Yeah, you kind of always want to be on your toes in this city.
I also know that the rent has to be, and the build out of the restaurant itself are, you know, of concern. So, you know, I don't, you know, if a busy night at Perse was 80, 90 covers and say, for example, most recently increased to 110, 120 covers, what would that do to the service? And what would that do to the dishes that are coming out?
Sure. I mean, yeah, it will strain it.
Yeah,
for sure.
Especially, you know, that caliber of cooking.
I mean, I cannot imagine that they won't come back.
I hope so.
And, you know,
I want to see them come back. Most definitely.
I think everybody does. I think they will. I mean, I think if they made such an impression on food culture, you know, in 2004 and up until now, I think they will continue to do so. Well, I want to send people to Sedell's. So where are they looking for you?
Where am I?
At Sedell's. Yeah. Where are you?
Where am I?
Yes.
Sedell's, where the location, do you want me to tell
you?
Yeah,
tell me the location.
Well, we're at 463 West Broadway between Prince and Houston Streets in Soho. And we're open Tuesday through Sunday. And we've got hot bagels through early, late afternoon. And then we switch over to dinner service.
Okay.
And that's where we are.
And you guys yell out hot bagels when they're ready?
We do.
And so is that like every hour on the hour or
it's more than that.
It's like every 20 minutes,
like every 25 minutes. Exactly. Yeah.
Are you constantly like, are the bagels ready? Or you've got a team that's got it pretty nailed down
right now. Okay. It took a while in the beginning to sort of get that flow adjusted. We've got it pretty nailed down. Some of the hot bagels go to the diners who are sitting down. Some of them go to the retail counter and some of the hot bagels go back to the kitchen.
Well, I'm going to attempt to get a hot bagel soon.
Awesome.
Okay, so we're going to take a break here on The Morning After. We're going to come back with The Morning After Quiz. Help me find a way outside, away from all the madness. Keeping everybody on the toes now, making it so hard to keep my balance. Balancing between the people we we're back here on The Morning After. We've been talking with Melissa Weller, head baker and managing partner at Sedell's. So Melissa Weller of Sedell's, you know all about bagels.
Like,
I hope I do. But what do you know about everyone's favorite stoner food? Bagel bites.
Oh,
this is your Morning After quiz.
Awesome.
Can you sing the jingle with me?
What is the jingle? Oh, no.
This is not... Okay, this should have been a question, man. This is not the first time I've sang this on the air, but... Pizza in the morning, pizza in the evening, pizza at supper time. When pizza's on a bagel, you can have pizza anytime.
Oh, my God.
Right? Thank you. I watched a lot of Saved by the Bell after school, and I'm pretty sure that, like... Bagel Bites was a sponsor.
That's amazing. Oh my God, you're right. Okay, now I remember.
All right, so getting you in the headspace.
Okay.
Which of these is not a pizza bagel bite flavor?
Oh no.
Is it A, Hawaiian? Is it B, extreme nacho? Or is it C, stuffed crust?
A, Hawaiian.
You are correct.
Woo-hoo!
It is, yeah, no Hawaiian. Damn it. Extreme nacho, by the way, is only available in Canada.
Oh, no way. I thought it would have been available here.
Well, you know how they love to supersize, not supersize, but just like put foie gras and everything.
Yes.
I wonder if there's extreme nacho on them, or like, you know, cheese curds, poutine, you know, all that stuff. All right. Question two.
Okay.
Just in reference to the jingle, if you watch TV during the 1990s, which Melissa Weller obviously did not, you know the Bagel Bites jingle. What song was sampled for the tune? Was it A, Sugar Time by the McGuire Sisters? Was it B, Lollipop by the Chordettes? Or was it C, Mama's Gonna Bake Us a Cake by the Casual Dots?
Oh, goodness. I'm going to go with Sugar Time.
Damn it.
Oh, that was a guess, but it sounded like it's like sugar
in the morning, exactly. Sugar in the evening, sugar at supper time.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah. It's perfect for you. Liz in the booth. I'm a little worried.
Oh,
I'm a little worried. I've only ever had two other people win the Morning After quiz. So,
oh, what do you win if you win it? Just the glory of winning it.
It's truly just the glory. Okay, yes. I don't have a lot to offer you. I can get you a pizza probably. All right. So
some bagel bites.
We could do that too. I'm sure we could find some around here in Bushwick. All right. Final question. Recently, Jimmy Fallon performed his Ode to Bagel Bites on The Late Show. Which famous singer joined him in the duet? Was it A, Justin Timberlake? Was it B, Meatloaf? Or was it C, Paul Simon?
Oh, now I'm going to get this wrong. I'm going to guess B, Meatloaf.
Melissa, how did you win the Morning After? Melissa Weller is the bagel queen.
Awesome.
She's the bagel queen. Yeah, it was with Meatloaf.
That was a guess, by the way.
I'm pretty sure they were all guesses. You didn't know any of them, did you?
No, I didn't know any of them. They were all guesses.
Man, you're a scientist, and I'm sure you used some deductive reasoning, and a hypothesis. Yeah. And
when
all
I was
those
in
things.
My 20s, mm-hmm. which was a long time ago, I was driving a car. I got out of about 20 tickets, speeding tickets, in like 1 year alone. I was really good at it.
Okay, so you're really smart at all sorts of things except for speeding.
Except for speeding, of course.
Well, Melissa Weller, thank you so much. You obviously are the bagel queen and so much more than that. Please visit her at Sedell's. This is The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.